Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It's going to be an interesting weekend. We're waiting to see what's happening with the January 6th committee, whether or not Nancy Pelosi will be adding Adam Kinzinger, hiring Denver Riggleman. As I tweeted out yesterday, Kinzinger, Cheney, and Riggleman, oh my. As I said in my newsletter, I'm not going to lie to you. It feels like kind of a Bulwark trifecta, but we won't get ahead of ourselves on all of that. How many of you actually thought that Sean Hannity was going to stay with the sober, responsible message that, you know, everybody should go out and take the vaccine seriously? He was widely praised for all of that. A lot of heavy breathing about the pivot on the part of Fox News and other people on the right who suddenly decided that, hey, maybe we shouldn't be screwed around with vaccine hesitancy, especially with the spike in the Delta variant. Well, the new sober, responsible Sean Hannity lasted about 3 days. In case you missed this, on Monday, he did tell it sounded like he was reading something that somebody had handed him about the need to take the coronavirus really seriously. Because I mean, after 600,000 deaths, it's time to sober up. It's time now to take this seriously. Well, apparently he got some blowback among his audience / the base, and so this is what he said last night.
I'm not urging people to get the COVID-19 vaccine because I'm not a doctor.
No, you're not.
That is not what I said.
Oh, no.
I said to take it seriously. Oh. It can kill you. I said to do a lot of research. If you have a phone, do your research. I said to consult your doctor and doctors.
Okay, sounds a little bit defensive there. Okay, take it seriously, but I didn't tell you to actually do it. I told you to Google it. Gives you some indication of the kind of blowback that he got. You know, we were talking about this with Trump in yesterday's podcast with Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker, that it's really important to understand that we talk about leadership a lot, but there's also this problem of followership, that people like Trump and Sean Hannity keep their finger on the pulse of the base and they don't want to get too far ahead. And so, you know, as a measure of what the mood out there in Red America is, Sean Hannity says, I want you to take this seriously. People are dying. Do the right thing. And feels the need to come back on the air on his radio show and television. So I didn't tell you to actually take it. I merely said you should do your research, whatever the hell that means. Yes. Go on Facebook. Talk to your aunt from Southern Arkansas. Find out what's really going on, because I definitely did not tell you that you should try to save your lives and do the responsible thing with vaccine. So I don't know. There we are as we go into the weekend, and we're at this pivot point with the vaccine. Some of them. I know we've been lectured by National Review that we should take the vaccine resistors, that we should take them seriously, and that we should show them respect. But some of these videos that you're now seeing online, including one guy who's he's on a ventilator, but he's insisting that he's not going to let them put that vaccine down his throat. It's like, okay, what do you say about all of that? Although I think perhaps we ought to have a conversation, a more robust conversation about vaccine passports, proof of vaccination, and perhaps whether or not the marketplace should begin to price in the cost of healthcare for people who refuse to do the responsible thing. Okay, so on today's podcast, I want to talk about one of the stories that we published in the Bulwark that has generated a huge amount of interest, in which I must admit that I have a morbid fascination about. It is the most read piece on our site 10 days ago. It's probably also the longest piece that we've ever run in the Bulwark, with the headline, What the Hell Happened to the Claremont Institute, by Laura Field. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for having me and for publishing it.
Well, no, I mean, thank you for writing it. And I'm going to admit that this may seem like a lot of inside baseball for many of our listeners. But, you know, in terms of the question of, you know, how the right lost its mind it's easy to talk about the low-hanging fruit, the Sean Hannitys, the Charlie Kirks, the Tommy Lahrens, and you know the other, you know, people in the clown car. But the other thing that's happened has been the this attempt to put an intellectual gloss on this. And it for people who are not familiar with this, it's kind of hard to overstate how respected the Claremont Institute used to be. And I want to read one paragraph that sort of sets this up, Laura. Okay. The Claremont Institute used to be one of the principal places for conservative intellectuals to come together. It was founded by scholars who were taken seriously, even by people who disagreed with them. And some such scholars still publish in the pages of the Claremont Review of Books. The Claremont has been unparalleled in its intellectual submission to Trumpism should give us pause. After all, in some respects, the Claremont crowd is precisely the sort who would have known better, deeply read in political philosophy and history, and familiar with the many warning signs that Trump would be a damaging and divisive president. There's also a sense, however, in which the Claremont crowd's submission to Trump was the most predictable thing in the world, the simple culmination of a political theory rooted in jingoism and denial. And then you go on to document what has happened to Claremont and the way they've given this sort of quasi-respectability to some of the rawest racism, conspiracy theories, hysterical rhetoric that you sometimes see on the right. So, again, let's just talk about why Claremont matters, because again, some of our listeners are going, I never even heard of all of that. But I mean, in terms of the right's intellectual infrastructure, they yeah. have a lot of influence. These think tanks, these pieces, because the influence is that the people who write op-ed pieces will sometimes read them. People will look and say, well, what am I, you know, what is a respectable conservative opinion? And for years, they've looked to people like Claremont, haven't they?
Yes, I think, I think today we have to be a little bit careful in asserting, in calling them still, you know, I don't think they are respected so much anymore.
Not anymore.
And they've sort of been isolated for a while. And that's partly because of Anton, but it's partly, I think, has to do with sort of fragmentation in the academy and polarization, because of politics. Sort of in the academy at large and sort of these cultural clashes between conservatives and the culture wars and all that. So I think that the Claremont Institute folks have been sidelined for quite a while. I think what I wrote there is true. There was a lot of respect. They were respectable for a good long while. I wouldn't want to say that they were respected by sort of left-wing intellectuals or anything. Like, no. There's still major divisions there, right?
Right.
But I think there were serious intellectuals writing for the Claremont Review of Books. And a lot of centrists and liberals would still read, I think, who were interested in seeing what was going on among conservatives would read that publication with interest.
Well, let's talk about you mentioned Michael Anton, and this is a measure of the influence of Claremont. Michael Anton wrote this quite influential piece back in 2016, Flight 93 election, where basically he was saying, okay, so if we should vote for Trump, even though we know that, you know, it might kill us all, but the prospect of the Democrats winning is so terrible that we need to treat this as if it is sort of the end of the world. And that got a tremendous amount of attention. And I think at the time there were some people who might have thought, well, that's kind of an outlier, you know, Michael Anton, you know, writing this hysterical piece about how we should charge the cockpit and we may all die, but everything is incredibly apocalyptic. But that's kind of the mood now at Claremont, isn't it? And that's the kind, and you wonder where ideas sort of seep out of. And Anton is really probably one of the highest profile folks at Claremont now, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's sort of, going back to your question about why we should care about this group and just sort of what it means that they have fallen sort of in line behind someone like Anton and the whole Trump movement. I think that Michael Anton, when he wrote that, it was an outlier piece. I think that probably most of the folks at Claremont looked at it with some real trepidation and thought, what is this guy doing? And then, you know, and it was, and he was certainly not an intellect, you know, somebody who was taken very seriously, but he obviously hit some sort of nerve with that piece. And he published it pseudonymously. It wasn't like, so he was even a bit hiding behind it, right? It was a cowardly sort of public move on his part, but he did it. And then Trump won. And I think one of the reasons I wrote the piece because I'm sort of fascinated with the relationship between sort of knowledge, right, and ideas and reasons and sort of rationalizations and power. And so you sort of see Anton give this very powerful rhetorical defense of Trump. Rhetorically powerful, not necessarily intellectually powerful, because it was just, I mean, I think it's easy to lose sight of just how repulsive the premise of the piece was. I mean, basically positing that Democrats are like the terrorists of 9/11. So just a really, really ugly premise there. But it took off partly because of that, the power of that kind of argument. And I think it was, you know, very much held, you know, people held their nose up to it on the among conservative intellectuals, but they saw how the effect that had. And you can overstate, I'm not saying that Anton won Trump the election, but Rush Limbaugh read that essay, right, on the air. And I think that kind of argument, a group like Claremont has all kinds of just like a very powerful arsenal of arguments at the ready, right, for whatever kind of political position they want to take. So they started doing that with Anton, and then I think they saw a possibility there to keep doing it, and they fell for the power of Trump, right, and the kind of attractiveness of that. And I think they believed them. They came to believe their own message about Democrats and about woke politics. Anyhow, so that's sort of how I see it, and I think it does matter a lot because those kinds of arguments are really powerful in the public sphere.
Well, that's right. And that's a perfect illustration of the way these arguments sort of start in a think tank, you know, or an obscure publication and then become very much part of the mainstream. And, you know, Rush Limbaugh reading that Flight 93 election piece, which then became part of the rationalization. This was part of the intellectual pretzeling of some folks who tried to figure out why they were doing it. Now, by the way, let's fast forward. I'm sure you've seen this. The most recent edition of the Claremont Review of Books, Michael Anton is back there.
Yeah.
And, now that we know that sometimes these ideas can be leading indicators, he's now playing around with the idea of a bloody civil war between Texas and California. And he compares our divisions now to the divisions in the Civil War, that back in the Civil War there was, and he quotes Lincoln saying there was only one substantial difference between us. And then he writes this. I mean, again, saying how much worse things are. Today, he says, it's hard to think of one substantial commonality. In 1861, the South feared the North, despite protestations to the contrary, would impose its will come hell or high water. Today's California makes no such protestations. It insists on its way or the highway. The bad news for Texas would seem to be that in any such contest, the side that wants it more tends to win. And then he talks about, well, what happens if there's a civil war? You know, if the Lone Star, way of life is to survive. Texans must fight for it. And here's the key sentence. Then we shall see whether California's long experiment with postmodern deracination, mm-hmm. and anti-masculinity can stand up to Texas's more robust embrace of the old virtues. I'm not a betting man, but were that conflict to erupt, my money would be on Texas. So, here we have the guy who gave us the Flight 93 election from Claremont, now writing in their premier publication, speculating of the possibility of a civil war between Texas and California. And this, again, is kind of a measure of what you're talking about, of what's happened at Claremont.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that one thing to just take notice of here is that, and these on the Claremont website, and especially like in the piece, I talk about how the Claremont Review of Books, which is sort of this staid publication, has a nice font. It looks very serious. It's sort of the flagship publication that people, you know, in intellectual circles probably would have heard of. But then there's also all of these other publications that are run there. Well, there's especially the American Mind, which is basically an online publication blog that gets all kinds of writers and is far sort of less serious on the face of it, and just more rhetorically charged than the Claremont Review. But they've been flirting with this stuff with secessionism in all kinds of different directions for a few years now, talking about sort of the division between rural and urban America, and just these sort of deep rifts that they see in the American culture. And I think one of the things worth noting is that from my view, obviously these things are very difficult to sort of decipher the truth of what's going on in America, right? You can't live everywhere. It's difficult to really get a grip on sort of American culture, which is, I think, extremely variable and regional and complicated and obviously quite fraught right now in some respects. But I think they project, or they see huge division and terrible, these, you know, there's this alarmism and this sort of apocalyptic way of speaking that they engage in, as if everything is just fraying and disintegrating right in front of us. It's very dystopian. And I think that, and this is very common, right, on the right, especially as I've been paying quite a bit of attention to the intellectuals who sort of support or at least are silent on Trump. And so it's a very common dystopian attitude, but my view is that they're not only projecting this onto American society, but they're also, fueling those flames relentlessly. And so, you know, these groups, especially in some of their online publications, they say that there's all this terrible, hatred and there's all these awful divisions, right? And someone obviously Trump sort of plays on that too, but they're fomenting it, right? There's two things going on. Yeah. And so that's what's so aggravating about so much of this.
Well, it is. I mean, and this is what's important here, is that you see these themes that the left wants to destroy America. They hate America. They hate God. They are doing all of this stuff. And there is in the background, these intellectuals who are really pushing all of this. Now, some people I know, I've said, hey, you know, keep your eye on the push for secession. I know it seems bizarre, but that's out there. It percolates in publications like this. Okay, so you devote a lot of time and I think it's fascinating in the piece, talking about the way Claremont has gone all in on the big election lie. The story of John Eastman, who was a law professor who actually spoke at the January 6th rally, who has spun one falsehood after another. Charles Kessler, who has been a longtime fixture in conservative intellectual circles, you know, the editor of the Book Review, how he has, aligned himself very specifically with Trump and with the election lie. But what I find, and this is what I wanted to, dig down with you, is there's also this element that is I think going to survive Trump and Trump himself. It's almost separate from Trump's own personal agenda, which is the really raw nativism, the flirtation with racism, the real fanatical sort of new post-liberal right-wing ideology. So let's talk about a guy that nobody's ever heard of before. Named Glenn Elmers, who you describe as a full-on fanatic. Now, we may think of him as a full-on fanatic, but Claremont thinks of him as an important voice. And in many ways, as I read your piece, I'm thinking, this guy right now is, he's the kind of person that's been around on the right wing for years and years and years, generally isolated in the crazy uncle corner. But now he's a voice, given a voice and a platform by Claremont. So tell us who Glenn Elmers is and what his message is and what he's putting out there into the right-wing ecosystem.
Sure. I think what your description of who he is was probably best in that he isn't someone who's well known at all. But the Claremont Review is, I think he's got an MA from the Claremont School. So he's sort of this school, maybe studied with Charles Kessler. And he's got a book coming out on Harry Jaffa, who is the sort of intellectual grandfather of the Claremont Institute. But he is not somebody.
Well, he's a senior fellow and he's influential. He's a senior fellow there. He's a visiting research scholar at Hillsdale College, speaking of formerly respectable institutions.
Yes, he is. But I guess I don't want to overstate his intellectual merits here. And I don't mean to be a snob, but I don't think he's somebody who people would have heard of, like you said. Right. And right. I think I did a quick Google search on him, right? And I don't think he's got sort of serious intellectual publications, but the Claremont Institute is publishing his stuff. And I think in the piece I described this really shocking thing they published of his about basically that conservatism is no longer enough. And so it was sort of a rallying cry manifesto for a new sort of post conservative or a new kind of reactionary conservatism a revolutionary conservatism, right? And he is trying to describe
the one authentic America.
Yes, the one authentic sort of understanding of America that Claremont understands. And so he sort of put himself out as basically he's going to be the poster guy for the kind of rhetorical face of something really ugly. I mean, it's hard to, I think without reading Glenn Elmer's piece, it's hard to describe just how sort of fanatical this piece was, but it was basically describing most.
I think we can explain it. I mean, he basically says, you know, there's the one authentic America, and the rest of the people in this country, people who didn't vote for Donald Trump, do not believe in, live by, or even like the principles, traditions, and ideals that until recently defined America as a nation, as a people. It is not obvious we should call these citizen aliens, these non-American Americans, but they are something else. So, I mean, he basically says, if you voted for Joe Biden, you're not really an American. And by the way, you do see that occasionally, this kind of feel, you know, in a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley tweet. So that's why, you know, he may not be intellectually substantive, but he is pushing these ideas out there, this identity politics that progressives, you know, are not just wrong on taxes, but they want to turn us into a nation of slaves. They want to throw us into the gulag. And I thought this was interesting. He says, America as an identity or political movement might need to carry on without the United States. So, I mean, this is really extreme rhetoric, but Claremont is publishing it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's sort of the kind of grossest, least subtle version of this. But I think the interesting thing is that substantively, even though the rhetoric is very highly charged, I mean, it's militaristic. There's just all kinds of, and there's racist lines. I mean, it's really gross if you read the whole thing. But substantively, and in terms of sort of the divisiveness and the kind of arguments that he's leaning on, it's not that different from what you get. I mean, it's sort of par for the course for Claremont now, but it's not that different from what you see in Charles Kessler. It's much more sort of carefully delineated, right? And he's much more hedging in his support for Trump. And in the kinds of arguments he deploys in the rhetoric, but his arguments substantively are not that far afield from this, because he basically thinks that there's, in his new book, he describes these two constitutions for America, right? There's sort of the good old constitution, and then there's a progressive constitution. And he taps into rhetoric of basically the House, you know, Lincoln and the House divided, to suggest that America's broken and there's only one way that we can come through this. So it's very similar to what we see in Anton today, right? This idea about that we're so divided now, it's all kind of a piece in terms of the sort of the arguments that underlie a lot of this. And I think
the loathing.
Yeah, and the sort of the mongering of divisiveness and a misreading too of sort of Democrats and liberals. I mean, I think it's just kind of perverse misreading of what Democrats stand for and leftists and of just their basic patriotism. I think that it's a severe sort of.
Well, it's also just the loathing. I mean, this is part of the weird thing is they claim to be patriotic and America first, but mm-hmm. you know what really runs through this is the loathing for fellow Americans, the loathing for the America that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
and you describe also you have actually a section in your article called The Lower Circles, and you know the raw racism of it. I just want to read you yeah. something from, and I remember reading this at the time. This was interesting, you know, that Elmers writes in his essay, if you are a zombie or a human rodent who wants a shadow life of timid conformity, then put away this essay and go memorize the poetry of Amanda Gorman. Amanda Gorman being the young African-American woman who read the poem at the inauguration. But the language zombie, human rodent, you know, shadow life mm-hmm. of timid conformity, I have to say this. There's a certain alien quality to this rhetoric that we generally, I mean, there's history to describing basically describing people you politically disagree with as not real, you know, members of the nationality as zombies or human rodents. And he doesn't pull back from that at all.
No, I know it's, it's hard to gauge how seriously to take them because it's so grotesque and it's sort of they seem so divorced from reality. But I think that would be a severe misunderstanding of what's going on here because we do know from history that this kind of dehumanizing and rhetoric is, I mean, the possible outcomes of that are sort of, you know.
Horrific.
Yeah, they're horrific, and I think it's very easy in American context to not take it seriously.
And, you know, I was talking with David Frum the other day on the podcast about whether or not, you know, to use the F word, fascist, to describe this. And I don't know how you describe this sort of language without seeing it in the historical context of this kind of hyper-nationalist. It has that sort of fascist attitude. Now, you also talk about, I mean, in getting it, you know, for people who think that we might be exaggerating this, mm-hmm. you write, the Claremont Institute has knowingly provided cover to and made common cause with an alleged white supremacist named Darren Beatty. And Beatty has a PhD in political philosophy from Duke. He was a speechwriter in the Trump White House, but was fired in August 2018 for having spoken at a conference in 2016 alongside white supremacists. This caused a stir at the Claremont Institute, since according to reporting at the time, Beatty appealed to the organization's listserv for help, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And yet they continue to embrace him and support him. And I found the most breathtaking part of your entire article was you found a series of tweets where Darren Beatty is tweeting out on January 6th just this raw stuff aimed at African Americans. Tim Scott needs to learn. Tim Scott, black U.S. Senator, Republican, needs to learn his place and take a knee to MAGA. BLM must take a knee to MAGA. They must learn their place. K. Cole James, who's the African-American president of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, needs to learn her natural place and take a knee to MAGA. And this just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And the president of the Claremont Institute actually seem to be promoting Beatty's racist rants. I mean,
we have to be just very careful with this, right? But because the president was not promoting those racist tweets, he was promoting Darren mm-hmm. Beatty, the person. But he was doing it the day after those racist tweets came out. Yeah. And so just to be clear.
Right. I mean, the fact that they're willing to even associate themselves with him is really remarkable. I mean, it really is. Hey, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more with Laura Field about what did happen to the Claremont Institute and how this organization transformed itself. We'll be right back. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to The Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like The Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. Okay, we're back with Laura Field, who wrote this amazing story about what the hell happened to the Claremont Institute. And I guess the big question I have to ask you is whether you think, Laura, Trump and the rise of Trump distorted, changed the Claremont Institute, or whether the seeds of this were planted a long time ago. And I guess that's kind of the fundamental question that a lot of us are wrestling with on the right. You know, how much of this was a black swan event, a deviation from an otherwise healthy conservative movement, and how much of it was sort of there and latent for a very, very long time, kind of the recessive gene. You seem to argue that there was something that was there all along in the Claremont Institute that made it especially susceptible to this kind of a turn. Is that correct?
Yeah, I definitely think there's something in sort of the philosophy undergirding the Claremont Institute that made this that sort of prefigured Trump, or was sort of sitting there in waiting for Trump. And I'll say something about that. But I also think that there's something kind of just in sort of the broad scheme of politics, there's something predictable about this happening. And it's not just because of the sort of latent beliefs of American conservatism or the Claremont Institute, but I think that it's a universal phenomenon in terms of, if you've got somebody who's become the president of the United States, no matter who that is, there are going to be people who line up behind him who are very smart, right? And so it doesn't really, so I think there's something that's just part of politics, right? Where you're going to get intellectuals who line up from on the right or on the left who want to be close to that and support that. But let me say a little bit about, I think, why this happened with Claremont and sort of maybe a little bit about the history of this institution that was peculiar, yes. But also, and then maybe after we can talk a little bit about some of the, I don't know if you want to, but some of the other intellectuals who are also sort of part of this. I guess just to say one sort of thing ahead of this is that the Claremont Institute is kind of the most extreme pro-Trump group of intellectuals, but they're not the only ones. And so I think there's a reason, there are a lot of sort of quiet people on the sides who sort of are happy that Trump happened, but and sort of support the change and the anti-establishment and the sort of the new openings in politics that has happened, but aren't as pro-Trump as Claremont. So, but why Claremont? I mean, I think they were founded in 1979, the Institute, by former students of Harry Jaffa, who was a very serious Lincoln scholar. And sort of, I mean, you can see in the article, I talk a little bit about Straussians, and Jaffa was a student of Leo Strauss. And I won't go into all of that background now, but basically Jaffa was someone who read the Lincoln-Douglas debates very seriously and sort of revived this serious encounter with some of the founders and with Lincoln, and when the sort of the political philosophy that Lincoln brought to the country, and sort of the political talents of Lincoln and the sort of the seriousness of him as a statesman. And so he sort of birthed this school of thought that revered the founders and that revered the founding as something sort of this magical almost moment in the history of the world, right, where you get this amazing bringing together of different sort of lessons from history of constitutional design in this moment and of the American founding through sort of enlightened rationalism plus some lessons from Christianity and ancient republicanism, and it sort of all came together for them as this sort of really important moment in history, and they became sort of myth makers around the founding. And even today, the Institute is devoted to sort of recognizing and studying the principles of the American founding. And so from a certain perspective, that's all, you can see how that's all very good and laudable and yeah, serious. And so that was, you know, 40 years ago or so. And I think in the course of time, you get some, it's become a little bit of a stagnant theory, and they've become quite jingoistic and a little, it's become, I guess maybe the word sort of idolatry fits, where it's become a very brittle myth making. And so there are ways in which this way of thinking are just very close to alternative ways of understanding history and the founding. And so you can just see how they'd be completely opposed to something like the 1619 Project. And just sort of, they've got their ears shut with respect to any critique of the founding, and their own understanding of the founding is very idiosyncratic and kind of narrow-minded. And it sort of erases all the serious contention and disagreement that happened at the founding, and not to mention the problem of slavery and all of the sort of hypocrisy of the founding. So there's a kind of problem with their way of understanding the founding, and they're sort of trying to make something perfect out of something that I think in truth is really messy and difficult. And so,
Well, and even the authors of the Federalist Papers made it very clear. I think they made, I mean, if you read the Federalist Papers, mm-hmm. they understood that it was messy, that there were problems. We obviously had to, you know, pass the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments to fix all of this. But yeah, even with that, even with the sort of sclerotic nature of their thinking, it does feel, it's hard for me to see a straight line between that, the way I remember them maybe 30 years ago, yeah, and what they've become now. Has it been, you know, again, I'm just speculating here, you know, in order to understand a lot of what's going on in some of these right-wing think tanks, one of the, you know, important questions is to ask, who are the funders? What are the funders asking for? Is it a matter of personnel? How do you go from serious thinkers to naming people like, you know, Jack Posobiec, you know, as a fellow? I mean, there's something about what's happening now where they're not even trying to be intellectually respectable in a way that would have been just routine just a few decades ago. Do you know what I mean? I mean, how do you get Charlie Kirk?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think there is something to do with obviously the money and the sort of wherever that's coming from, or wherever they've found a big audience who's willing to pay them for that is a major, you know, a major important question. But I also think that through this history, I mean, I think that we don't want to underestimate the extent to which they are serious ideologues now who believe that their America is under, you know, existential threat because of woke liberals. I think that is something right, that they are convinced about. And so to the extent that Charlie Kirk or whatever, you know, Turning Point USA or Ben Shapiro, right, all these guys are willing to, and Donald Trump are willing to own the libs and you know, and work their magic with their, you know, with the loathing and hatred, I think that they think that it's worth it. And they really believe that because they think that they're the heroes who are saving real America. So I think, yeah, and it also brings in a lot of money, and there's a lot of people who agree with that, right?
So people, I mean, understand when I say Jack Posobiec, I mean, he's well known as the promoter of the Pizzagate hoax and the Seth mm-hmm. Rich conspiracy theory. I mean, he's the kind of guy that you might see on, you know, One America News Network now. And then Claremont, though, is proud to be affiliated with him. I mean, they call him one of the best public policy voices in America, which is like, what? You know, as you point out, just days before it was revealed that a right-wing website that Posobiec promoted was a Russian disinformation project. And I guess the one that makes your head hurt is this, they have these Lincoln Fellows, which at one point was a very prestigious position for conservatives, and naming Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA. I mean, this is a guy who's basically kicked out of Liberty University after his, you know, his association with Jerry Falwell Jr. imploded, and the Claremont Institute welcomed him with open arms. I mean, Kirk is almost like this living cartoon figure. So I'm still trying to struggle with how does an organization that has such a tradition and still has intellectual pretensions figure, yes, let's go name Charlie Kirk and the Pizzagate guy. Unless somebody's just writing a big check and saying, these are our folks.
Yeah, I don't have the answer for that. I mean, my guess is that there's just a sincere conviction with most of these guys that the threat is real, right? And so deploy whatever means necessary. And I think, I mean, the reason I think—
Even if it's stupid and racist?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely cynical on the one hand, but I come from this sort of same Straussian background that some of these people did or Jaffa used to, not the same. I mean, that's a pretty big world and has all kinds of, you know, conflict and disagreement within it. But I think one thing that some of these sort of students of Strauss and of the ancients, really, they have a very different attitude towards sort of philosophy and knowledge than we might expect from like an ordinary think tank. And I think that one thing that these guys appreciate is they appreciate the extent to which sort of certain kinds of arguments can be deployed prescriptively to try to culture, right? And so I think that they're doing this actively, knowing that it can have a big effect, and they're not sort of shy about the fact that they are actively trying to shape politics, and that they're sort of open to all kinds of
No, that's
and
true.
I think they're quite open about how they're going to use sort of psychological tactics and rhetorical, dangerous rhetoric. That's sort of part of their shtick. And so they just kind of, I don't know if they don't take the danger seriously. I mean, I think that's what's gone. Like, I think they don't quite know, but it's very hard to understand. I mean, I think my point is I'm quite perplexed by this too, right? And in terms of how
Okay. You ask a series of questions, though, that I found fascinating right near the end of your piece. You said you wondered, do the respected scholars and thinkers who continue to write for the Claremont Review of Books agree with the new direction of the Institute? Do they think that contributing only to the higher-end publication insulates them from being associated with the grossest parts of the overall Claremont project? Similarly, do all of Claremont's scholars and fellows, their hundreds of fellowship alumni, including former faculty fellows, feel comfortable having their names used in fundraising efforts on behalf of the Institute's latest undertakings, or will they voice an objection? And are the foundations whose grants fund Claremont, including a number of small family foundations, aware of what the Institute has become? Do you know the answer to those questions? Because I think those are fascinating, fascinating questions.
I do not know the answers to those questions. I mean, I wish I did.
It's kind of hang out there. They just hang out there.
Yeah, they're genuine questions. I'm genuinely perplexed by the names that I see still publishing with the Claremont Review of Books. You know, Harvey Mansfield, Jim Caesar, Matt Crawford, Christopher Caldwell, Diana Schaub. I mean, these are people who, I mean, I have major political differences with them and I always have, right? I just don't understand it. I don't know. Maybe they have a different way of judging the dangers of the kind of the gross nonsense garbage that the other publications of the Claremont are promoting. Maybe, but I don't know how they could be blind to that at this point.
I mean, so the questions that you're asking, though, are really highlight the collapse of the guardrails of the conservative movement. I mean, these are the people that you're asking the questions of are the people who normally, you know, in the past you would have thought would say, OK, we're not going this far. OK, this is what we believe. We're outraged. We have sincere beliefs, but we are not going to associate with a Darren Beatty. We're not going to associate with a Glenn Elmers. We're not going to run crazy. You know, we're not going to be associated with, crazy conspiracy theories of a John Eastman, and God knows we're not going to have, Flight 93 forever. Or even if they did say that, they would have some standards. And I think that the fact that you don't have that is what makes this story so clear, that Claremont or the people that you're talking about, the scholars, the fellows, the alumni, the funders, these could have been the people who would have said, hey, are you kidding? Let's stop there. And they're not, which is what makes this story so fascinating. You can read this in the Bulwark. It is a long, deep dive. Laura Field has done just an absolutely magnificent job. What the hell happened to the Claremont Institute, which is really, in many ways, what's happened to the conservative movement, what has happened to the conservative mind. Laura, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.